This is Media Sales Mastery, the podcast for media sales professionals. In each episode, we bring you information, insights, and ideas from some of the industry's top thought leaders. Connect with us to help pick the topic and guide the show.
This is Media Sales Mastery, the podcast for media sales professionals. I am your host, Jamie Wood, and today's episode is all about crafting a sales strategy. Now, I have to put an apology out there. I was going to do this as a LinkedIn Live event, and I did promote it on LinkedIn. Unfortunately, I went to India for work. I came back. I got a horrible head cold. To be honest, I'm probably still not fully over it. Rather than jumping on and doing a full live thing and sort of waiting until I'm better, I just wanted to jump in to a room here at my WeWork. I'm here on a Sunday afternoon, so you'll hear a bit of background noise, but hopefully you can persist, because today is really about just going through the fundamentals of a sales strategy. So I'm just going to jump right in. The first thing to remember here is that this is my opinion only, and this isn't really a textbook framework to approaching strategy. It's just an approach that I found has worked for me. There is a book that I've lent on really heavily called Playing to Win, How Strategy Really Works. Now, I forget the name of the two authors, but they were actually two of the lead strategists for Procter & Gamble. So not even in the media sales space, this book, but it covers off a lot of the fundamentals of good business strategy and how it all works. So I've sort of borrowed a couple of their terms. And one of the other books that's worth reading is a book called Blue Ocean Strategy, which is a heavy read. You want to be well caffeinated and really, really keen to stick with it. But it's a great book as well. Gives a really good understanding and some great examples of really good strategic decision-making by businesses. But I wanted to give the context as to why I want to do this topic. It's off the back of a post I did on LinkedIn where I made the comment that it's remarkable how few media sales teams actually have a defined sales strategy. Now, that's from working in multiple publishers myself. That's from working with multiple publishers, and it's from talking to people who sell media. If you were to say, what is your team sales strategy or what is your own sales strategy, you would get a whole bunch of different things kind of coming back at you. But some of them actually aren't even really a strategy, right? So there is a bit of a misconception as to what a sales strategy is. And that's probably the first thing that's, you know, really important to address. So a sales strategy is not a vision. Okay, you might have a company that says, we want to be the media publisher of choice for the advertising market and deliver the best solutions to our customers. Now, that's not necessarily a sales strategy. Okay, it could be part of a decision-making process for a strategy, but that alone is not a strategy. A six-step sales process or sales methodology, again, that's not a strategy as such. Going out to market and doing a whole bunch of events and being really on the front foot with client engagement, not necessarily a strategy, but could form part of one. So the first thing that's really important to define is what actually is a sales strategy. And I'm going to try to give you my definition of it. A sales strategy is basically a decision around where to allocate time, people, and money in order to generate the greatest overall return on investment, specifically revenue. So I'll say that again. A sales strategy is about making deliberate decisions and choices as to where to allocate time, people, and money in order to generate the greatest overall return on revenue. So when we think about it like that, what we need to really remember is that a strategy is unique to a business, it's unique to a marketplace, it's unique to an individual. And as much as possible, what I'm trying to do is to keep this topic really broad. You could be an executive leader running a national sales team, or you could be a media salesperson in your second month on the job. The principles of a good sales strategy and the principles of this process I'm about to go through should be interchangeable and should be applicable to both your worlds. So if we think about this in terms of working through what a strategy actually is, here's where we would start. And it's a bit of a quote. I don't know who originally came up with it, but essentially it is, strategy is about sacrifice. You can't be all things to all people. Okay, so this is a bit of a reframe that a lot of people need to think about. Strategy is not necessarily just about what you decide you're going to do. It's equally about what you decide you're not going to do. And I'm yet to see any company that has been successful by being all things to all people or by not having a clearly defined strategy that they adhere to. Now, I do get a bit of heat when I say this because people throw examples at me like, oh, look at Amazon. Amazon do retail and logistics and they're a data company and now they're moving into media and retail media. Or look at Apple. You know, Apple started as desktop computers, but now they've moved into all these consumer products. I can guarantee both those companies still make deliberate decisions around what markets, opportunities, customers they are not going to pursue in order to be good at pursuing the opportunities they are, right? So it doesn't matter how capable a company is, doesn't matter how broad, you will find that they are still making deliberate sacrifices around things they choose not to do. But let's work through this together. So if you've got a bit of paper in front of you and you want to start fresh, maybe you're starting a new year, maybe you're starting a new role, maybe you just need a bit of a reset to get yourself out of a rut and you want to go through this process with me and design a strategy for your sales scenario. The first thing we want to do is we want to answer this very specific question. What does winning look like? Okay, what does winning look like? So if you're playing along at home, you've got to remember that everyone who's in business is in business to win. Okay, one of the biggest mistakes that I've seen people make, particularly in sales roles, is that you either don't define what success looks like, incredibly demotivating, or conversely, you let the company decide what success looks like for you. Okay, both of those are very dangerous, and I'll tell you why. Because if we start thinking, what does winning look like in the context of sales, it becomes very easy to be really ambiguous. Oh, winning looks like being the number one sales team in the market. Okay, well, what the hell does that look like? Okay, who's saying you're number one? On what metrics are you evaluating that against? Being number one and saying you're number one, is that what you tell yourself? Is that what your customers tell you? Is that what the company tells you? Is that what finance tell you? Is it a market share thing? Is it to do with a customer NPS score? You've got to think more specifically around what does winning look like in that context. If your goal is to be the number one sales team in your market, which is a fine goal, by the way, and if that's what winning looks like to you and that's achievable, great, but you've got to put some specific, measurable, actionable, realistic, time-bound goals against that so that you can evaluate where you were at in terms of your progress towards that goal. Okay? You've got to remove the ambiguity when it comes to what does winning look like. Now, on the other side of that, where we can probably have a bit of an issue is when we get too literal with what does winning look like and people start thinking about winning as just being a revenue-based outcome only. You know, winning for me is hitting 12 budgets in a row every year. It's like, okay, great, that may actually be what winning looks like for you, but think about the context of that. What about if you are in your first year as a media sales professional? Do you think it's realistic you're going to hit all 12? Do you think that's going to drive the right kind of short-term behavior? Does that actually feel like something that you can do? Does that feel within your sphere of influence or control? Or does that feel a little bit too left up to chance? You know, if you're a new sales director coming in and winning for you looks like hitting all 12 budgets, well, maybe that's the case. But if you're a sales director inheriting a new team and winning to you is hitting every budget, straight away, that might actually govern some very interesting decision making on your behalf. Maybe you don't move underperformers out of the business or bad, you know, people who are bad cultural fits. Maybe you don't move them out of the business because they're helping you hit your monthly budget. Maybe you're frustrating your clients and you're over-contacting your clients, but you're still hitting your revenue number, so you decide that's not an issue. These are the types of things that you need to think about. Okay, like if winning is just about revenue, or if winning is some really ill-conceived, ill-defined, wishy-washy objective, then it's very difficult to build a coherent strategy in order to go and actually achieve that. So you've got to think about what does winning look like? Then you have to think about it from the perspective of how do I make this tangible and measurable? And how do I make this something that I can actually achieve? And this is where you have to be realistic. If you're working for the number one media publisher in the market and you've got all the resource, fantastic engagement budgets, a great product, you know, great smarts, great capability, clients love working with you, maybe winning does look like being the number one sales team in the market. But maybe within that, you need to set some parameters around having the highest staff engagement score in your company, having the number one net promoter score from your clients in the market, and taking an unfair share or a premium share revenue out of the market in terms of what you should be taking versus what you are. Okay, those metrics, if you were to achieve all three of those, I think it would be undisputable that you're probably number one. But if you're like a third or fourth tier publisher, and I say this with respect, if you're a publisher that has a quarter of the audience of your nearest three competitors, if you're a publisher that's a low-cost operator, doesn't have a lot of investment going back into the business, maybe you're in a medium that is sort of declining in terms of audience levels, setting a goal of being the number one publisher or number one sales team in the market, it might need a bit of tweaking, a bit of an adjustment so that it's actually realistic and achievable, right? And the thing to remember here is if you're listening to me now going, well, that sucks, it doesn't, because actually if you are in a situation where you aren't the number one, like the overwhelming number one or one of the market leading publishers, strategy can actually unlock some hidden opportunity and can unlock that competitive advantage that can allow you to still be successful. Okay, so that's an important caveat I need to make. But the first thing you need to do is to really kind of look at it from the perspective of what does winning look like? Okay, how are we going to measure it? What timeline are we working towards? And I think if you were to probably think about this in the context of your own space, you need to look at it sort of as something aspirational, sort of as something that feeds into a vision, but also something that has some pretty kind of common sense currency against it and some metrics against it. Because if you're a sales leader, if you're a salesperson, it's not just about you deciding what success is. You have to think about the context of the business you're operating in. Okay, what are they going to collectively agree is success for you? If you've got a company that's wanting $37 million of annual revenue out of your market every year and you're leading it, you're going to have to find a way to maybe make that part of the what does winning look like. But don't make it solely about that. That's the point I'm trying to get at. Okay, so we've gone through the process of just thinking really, really pragmatically around what does winning look like. Here's the part where if you are somebody who's naturally, I'm not going to say negative, but if you're somebody who's naturally quite attuned to playing devil's advocate, if you're somebody who's feeling a bit cynical, if you're somebody who feels like you've got a lot of blockages in your current world, in your current role, this is where you need to park that and you need to flip your thinking to being very pragmatic and very open-minded, okay? And I'm not suggesting that's easy to do because you don't want to be too optimistic that you aren't still keeping this anchored in reality. But the next thing you need to think about here does require you to have a bit of a fresh perspective and some open-mindedness, and you need to think laterally about this problem. The next question is where to play, okay? And where to play, if there's one question out of this whole strategic framework that can pretty much define if you're going to be successful or not, it's being able to correctly identify where to play. So where to play is about identifying which part of the market you are going to focus on most of the time. Okay, and to that point earlier around strategies about sacrifice, you can't be all things to all people. In media sales, one of the biggest mistakes I see people make is that they think that anyone who has the means or desire to buy advertising is a customer. Okay, that might technically be true, but if you take the perspective that everyone is your customer or anyone who has an advertising budget could be your customer, you are going to spend a hell of a lot of time working on low return, unfocused activities. So to that point earlier around where to play, it's about identifying a particular part of the market that offers the most opportunity and the most upside if you were to focus on it most of the time. Okay, so when we talk about strategy as being about deciding where to put time, people, and money, where are you going to put time, people, and money most of the time in order to get the most return on that investment? And this is where I get again, a lot of resistance when I have this conversation, because my background predominantly is actually agency sales. It's probably what I've spent the most time in my career doing, both leading agency sales teams and working in agency sales. And the first thing somebody will say to me is, where to play? Jamie, I've already got a list of agencies that I look after. My opportunity is pretty much bound by the customers or the clients that the agency has. Yeah, absolutely. I don't dispute that at all. Okay. But within that predefined territory, you still have the opportunity to identify where to play. The converse of this is people who might work in like a smaller market. So maybe you work at a regional market with a population of 200,000 people. You know what, Jamie? There's only a handful of clients that even have advertising budget in my town. I need to know all of them. I need to spend time servicing them all. And I don't have these massive opportunities over here to go and find new clients. That's totally fine, right? In those scenarios, you still can find what I would kind of consider to be the most fertile opportunity within that predefined customer base. And what I mean by that is, if you were to sit down and look at the agency that you sell into or the market and all the customers and do a really simple SWOT analysis against that whole customer base. Let's say there's 30 clients within three agencies you look after. I guarantee that if you sit down and you do a SWOT analysis of yourself versus your competitors in that particular customer's world, you know, what are your strengths versus theirs? What are your weaknesses? What are the opportunities? What are the threats? You are going to uncover opportunity within that where you are uniquely positioned to service that client in a way that the competitors can't. Okay, now the flip side of that might be, you know what? Yeah, we are, Jamie. We're totally well equipped to service these two customers out of 30, but guess what? They spend the least. Okay, that's fine too. You still have to think about it in terms of where can we find what I would kind of deem to be two things. One is uncontested market space. Or two would be market space where you are best equipped to have a fair fight, right? It's kind of like thinking about it in terms of fighting in the right weight division, okay? You're not going to go and box somebody who's 130 kilograms if you're 70 kilograms. But if you were to go and fight somebody who's 70 kilograms or below in a you know, the same weight division or a slightly lower weight division, then you might actually have a greater chance of being successful. Now, this is sort of like, that's a little unrelated to what I'm saying, but it's about identifying where can you have a fight where you have, where the odds are stacked in your favor to be successful, particularly if you're in a tight competitive market. If, on the other hand, you don't sell into a customer base that's that tightly defined, you can have the alternate problem of anyone's our customer, you know, the whole market is complete green fields and I can go out and see anyone I want to because our product is relevant for everybody. That would be a mistake too. Okay, that would actually be a bigger mistake because that's a very scattergun approach. And think about it like this. It's like if everyone's your customer, great. But out of those customers, who are the most attractive customers? And when you think about strategy, it's also about identifying what I guess I would call uncontested market space. So where are those places in the market that offer a great return on investment for your effort that maybe no other publisher is potentially talking to at the moment, right? If you can get that, happy days, okay? It's that whole idea, they call it a blue ocean versus a red ocean. And the mental image would be a blue ocean is pristine, beautiful blue water. You're swimming there on your own. You can eat all the fish you want. A red ocean is basically blood in the water. There's a bunch of sharks. They're all competing and fighting over finite opportunity for food. It's a bloodbath, basically, right? Really good strategy is very much about identifying where can I actually play in order to be successful. If I can get into a blue ocean, if I can get completely out of this whole contested market space and I've got a relevant customer base that want to transact with me and then I'm going to get the maximum return on investment for my time and energy by servicing this part of the market, happy days. Alternatively, you might go, you know what, I'm playing in a red ocean, I got a bunch of competitors, but I've uncovered some competitive advantage and some reasons why I've differentiated enough that I feel like most of the fights I'm going to have, I'm positioned to be successful and take a great share of that market. Either way, the where to play thing is really, really critical, because if you don't define that correctly, again, like I said, you're either going to spend your time fighting a battle you can't win, right? Meaning you're going to be going and taking on a market leader and you're going to be undermanned, undergunned, and you're not going to have that capability. Or you're going to be going out completely unfocused, speaking to a whole range of different customers, being completely pulled from pillar to post, and not necessarily doing any one thing well. So the where to play thing is super, super critical. And let me give you an example of something outside of media to kind of give you some tangible examples. So, you know, Coca-Cola and Pepsi, notorious rivals. Coca-Cola, very much the market leader, very dominant in most Western markets around the world. Pepsi made a deliberate decision around where to play about 10 years ago, and they needed to grow their business because winning, what does winning look like? It looks like growth. So they made a decision in order to get the growth that they needed to, in order to win, the way that they had to do that was they needed to actually move into new market space where they were better equipped to grow. And what they made a decision to do was to move into India. Okay. Coca-Cola has a monopoly on this part of the globe. India's got scale. India's got a massive consumer base. Coca-Cola haven't necessarily established their product, their brand, their supply chain, their distribution to the level that we potentially could right now. And we can go and set up shop over there as Pepsi. And basically we can grow and we can win by expanding into and playing in a different market. So a where to play decision was about moving into a different market. The one example when you think about uncontested market space is something like Cirque du Soleil. So if you think of Cirque du Soleil, it's actually a circus product, right? If you said, what is it? It's a circus. Okay, but if you think about what a circus has traditionally been for people, circuses have been traveling carnivals. They've been relatively, they've been relatively kind of grassroots. There's sort of been a bit of stigma attached to them around things like animal cruelty and around controversy with the training of the animals. They're known as being a little bit sort of unclean. There's a bit of a stereotype around carny folk, all that kind of stuff. Cirque du Soleil differentiated by elevating what they did, making it a premium offering by, you know, having world-class acrobatics and by kind of creating a whole new category in the circus genre, if you will. So that's an example of where to play. They were playing in a more elevated, more premium space, but still very much taking revenue out of that circus marketplace and taking revenue out of that entertainment market. So those are some examples outside that might get you to think a little bit differently about how this might apply to your world. The where to play one, like I said, I wrote some notes here, but the biggest thing is, you know, it's about trying to also uncover if there's an unmet need by customers. So what I mean by that is, you know, in a market like Brisbane, for example, which is where I've spent the majority of my time, it's a really unique media market in that there's like anywhere from 400 to 500 clients in the market, but about half the revenue in the market comes from the top 25 clients. So from a where to play perspective, where most publishers are in a situation where they all need to play with those 25 clients, right? In order to have the scale of opportunity, in order to have the ability to extract the most amount of revenue, you know, those 25 clients are all being vied for by most of the publishers. However, uncontested market space isn't just about them not having customers, not currently having a conversation with competitors. It might actually be that there's a need that's being unmet that you are uniquely positioned to solve. So if you're thinking about your product and you're going, look, it's a pretty tight market, they've got a whole raft of options of where to put their dollar, it might be about kind of going, well, maybe there's something that I can potentially service that isn't currently being serviced correctly. So that where to play thing, you've got to really think about it multidimensionally. You can't just think about it as I'm going to go play over here. You have to think about it in terms of uncontested market space, lots of opportunity. Where are my competitors either not playing or not focusing or not strong? Where can I put my time, people, and money in order to get the greatest overall return? Hey, this is Jamie. Thank you for listening to this podcast on crafting a sales strategy. Now, one of the absolute central tenets of great sales strategy is uncovering a competitive advantage. You know, when we talk about this whole idea of where to play, really identifying where to play is about identifying where your competitive advantage is going to really resonate and really work for you. We've done a podcast in the past with the wonderful Sarah from Spotify in the US. Here's a snippet of it now. It's all about unlocking competitive advantage.
I do think that competitive advantage is really important because it plays into your value proposition. It can really trigger purchases. It'll be the reason brands and agencies buy from you and not from someone else.
That was Sarah Williams from Spotify over there in New York. And that was an episode titled Unlocking Competitive Advantage. Once you listen to this episode, go back, have a listen to that one too, because the two of them are very much interrelated and work together. Bit to unpack there, but once you define where to play and you know what success looks like, the next one is how do you win? Okay, and how to win is where a lot of people actually, I think often a lot of people start to think that like tactics and strategy, this is where they get differentiated because a lot of the time the how to win comes down to some of the tactics that you employ. So I'll give you an example of a how to win strategy that I put in place in a previous team. I was leading a radio sales team and we had really defined that what does success look like? It was taking an unfair share of the market. It was taking a premium on our audience. So if our audience position was 20%, we wanted to take more than 20% of the available advertising dollars in the market. When we looked at our where to play, what we uncovered is that the majority of the time when we received a brief targeting females 25 to 54, the majority of the time we were successful in securing that revenue, right? That was where we were uniquely equipped to play, is that we had a customer profile, an audience profile that was very distinct, that our competitors didn't have, that we were able to compete. We had a competitive advantage on particular briefs focusing on that audience. Okay, so what we identified was where to play. We had to play in that space where there were brands that wanted to connect with females 25 to 54. The how to win was interesting, okay? Because if we were to just sit there and go, okay, all we're going to do is bring our A game on these briefs that are targeting females 25 to 54, we wouldn't get to our number and we wouldn't take an unfair share of the market. So the how to win became about, we need to expand the number of briefs that come to us targeting females 25 to 54. We need to be known in the market as the experts when it comes to targeting and advertising to this particular audience. We need to make sure that the market across the board knows that this is an audience proposition that we have that makes us distinct and unique. We needed to protect our rate integrity when we got those briefs so that we could maximize our yield and maximize our profitability. We needed to offer best in market integration. We needed to have great talent that we had available. So there were a whole raft of things that needed to align in order for us to be able to kind of realize that competitive advantage and to make sure that the where to play, that we were being successful when we were playing in that arena. So the how to win really became about identifying a number of different initiatives that allowed us to increase the number of female 25 to 54 briefs. Okay, and I think this is one where I probably need to give some different examples because some people might think this is just about tactics, and for the most part, it actually is about tactics. Okay, but it could be something as simple as, how do I win in my market? You know, we've got the best audience already. We're the number one. We're always going to get the briefs. So our how to win is really simple. It's an operational strategy. We just need to make ourselves the easiest to buy and the easiest to sell for. We need to focus on our process. You know, we need to have great customer service. We need to have really prompt response to brief. We need to do great post-campaign reports. That could be a how to win strategy. Okay, that could absolutely be a how to win strategy, but it needs to be aligned to the what does winning look like and the where to play in order for it to make sense. If you were, for example, a publisher that didn't get briefed or didn't really get on the buy, you could be the best and easiest to buy in the world, but it wouldn't necessarily work for you because you wouldn't be doing anything to stimulate more demand. So in the case of that type of publisher, your how to win strategy might have to be that you're the most aggressive sales team in terms of your outbound prospecting. You know, you're going to do a number of visibility tactics in market that's going to raise the profile of your product, going to connect you in with more customers, and it's going to expand the contact occasions with customers so that they have a relationship with you, and therefore you're able to uncover unique opportunities to sell your product. So the how to win becomes very much a consequence of the first two questions. And sometimes, you know, how to win is about product innovation. It's about constantly being on the bleeding edge of new technology. You know, we're going to win in this market by constantly coming to our customers with new innovative thinking and different products. Sometimes it's not about that. Sometimes it's about, like, you know what, the market, it's got a whole bunch of noise. Our customers are confused. We're, you know, our how to win strategy, we're just going to be that solid number two publisher. We're going to let all the complexity sit over here with the publisher who takes 80%. And we're going to just sell ourselves as a great complementary provider who could take that other 20% of their budget and support a campaign. Now, there's actually no problem with doing that. And I think sometimes good sales strategy, the biggest enemy of sales strategy, can sometimes just be ego. Everybody thinks they want to be the best. Everybody thinks they want to be number one. Customers who are self-aware enough to go, you know what? We're not number one. We don't have all the resourcing. We probably don't even have the best product. But here's what we do have. We've got pricing and trading flexibility. We've got a lot more inventory. We've got a little bit more time on our hands to be proactive. And customers seem to like dealing with us. Therefore, our how to win strategy in this market is we're going to look at the things that we do well, and we're going to double down on those. And we're going to focus on playing in a part of the market that appreciates that. And we're not going to go and fight for 80% share against our most capable competitor who's probably going to win that. Okay, we're going to pick our battle. We're going to preserve our resources. And we're going to put time, people, and money into this area because we know we can be successful here. So this is the thing, I think, you know, sometimes where, particularly if you're in a sales team, and maybe you aren't tasked with creating the sales strategy, you're just in the sales team, and maybe you're not even part of creating that strategy, or you don't have visibility on what it is. This is where sales teams can get very frustrated and feel very unfocused and can burn out, is if you've got a sales leader who's constantly putting tactics in, like, we're going to go do a market visibility tactic, we're going to go take this product out, we're doing a new business drive. You know, now it's all about us going out and selling this particular product. Okay, sales teams can get very frustrated by that because A, it feels unfocused. B, it feels like it's kind of changing on any given day or any given month. And most importantly, it doesn't really ladder up to an overarching strategy. You don't put it into context. If I'm going to do a market visibility tactic where, you know, we're going to put an incentive in for the team that if they go and see 50 customers this month, they're going to unlock some sort of an incentive or bonus. You better believe I've got to put that into context as to where to play, what customers are we going to actually go and see, right? And why are we going to contact these customers at such a high level? And what does winning look like? What's the overarching reason we're doing this? You know, guys, we aren't going to be successful and we aren't going to get to our how to win goal if we just sit back and allow the market to trade the way it is. Where we're going to play is we're going to focus on these particular customers because they're the most relevant for us. But how we're going to win is we're going to have to go and engage them more than anyone else in the market in order to get on their radar and to extract more conversations and more briefing opportunities. Okay, that tactic makes sense because I've put it into context and there's a strategic decision-making framework that I've gone through. And so here's the final thing. Okay, and let me just do a quick recap if you're playing along at home, because I'm not talking about strategic implementation. I'm just talking about giving you a framework to devise a very basic level sales strategy. What does winning look like? Where to play? How to win? This is the second most important. If where to play is the most important, the second most important is this one I'm about to say now. What are we not going to focus on? What are we not going to focus on? Sales strategy is about sacrifice. You can't be all things to all people. It's about putting time, people, and money into the areas that generate the greatest overall return. It's about focusing on the areas that are uncontested where you can be successful, or focusing on the areas where you are uniquely positioned to win. So hear me when I say that what you choose not to do is equally as important as what you choose to do. Nothing will derail a strategy like an unfocused sales team that are undisciplined and don't know how to prioritize or sacrifice particularly low return activities. And I think it's safe to say, I've been a sales director a long time, and it's safe to say there's a lot of people where maybe I'm not particularly liked. I'd like to think I'm respected, but I'd say I'm not particularly liked because I've been very, very, very protective of my sales team's time. And I've been known to push back on low return activities, low return initiatives, or things that do not align to our sales strategy. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, the things that don't align to the strategy are actually the fun things to do. Okay. And this is where, if you really want to be good at executing sales strategy, you've got to be good at delaying gratification, and you've got to make sure that you don't get lured away by shiny toys. So let me give you an example of what not to do. In that example I had before around females 25-54 being a core sweet spot of the radio team. Let's say a massive brief hits your lap and it's targeting blue collar males under the age of 40, tradespeople selling a brand new power tool. Okay, and it's got a pretty sizable budget against it. Well, that's $1 million. We got to have a crack at that. Let's really go in and do our absolute best. In fact, let's go and engage this client over the next year because they're spending with that network. I want them to spend with us. Maybe you could be successful, right? But think about how much time and energy you might have to devote to something like that. And think about the probability that you're going to be able to take that revenue and put it onto your radio network. Okay, that's a great example for a real scenario. Now let's think about some hypothetical ones that might come up. You got the product team coming in and wanting everyone to sit on an hour training session to learn about this really exciting new digital product. Okay, there's a lot of pressure for a frontline seller optically to participate in that, to be seen participating in that. So that's where you really have to think about this. If 80 to 90% of the revenue I write this year comes from this product, if we're currently not doing these things well, if our strategy is all about, you know, how to win in this place, and I've got a product over here that's going to take 20 people off the floor for an hour, going to distract them, divert their focus away from the main strategy over here, and then get them focused on a product that doesn't actually align to my strategy and won't make an impact to my how to win, that's an uncomfortable conversation you as a leader have to have, okay? Because there's these constant trade-offs that happen. And the problem is you might only go, oh, look, it's only an hour, but it's an hour times 20 of productive selling time that you could be putting towards the other strategy. So these are the little time thieves. These are the little things that can really, really easily distract a sales team. You know, sales planning is another one where the sacrifice thing is massive. Sales planning, I've always found, is really, really important to almost kind of like work through the strategy, have the strategy crystal clear before you start thinking about client hit lists and before you start thinking about initiatives to go and proactively target clients. Because what I find happens is, oh, I really want to go and get some money out of this client, and I really want to go talk to these clients, and these guys aren't spending with us, but I'd love to talk to them too. Again, it's like, if these customers represent the customers in your where to play framework and you rightfully think they should be spending with you and they're not, and you think that with a bit of focused conversation, you could convert that revenue, absolutely go for it. But if those clients don't align to that where to play strategy, if they don't feel like you're going to get that return on investment from the investment in time, if they feel like they're going to be better serviced by another publisher, if there's another publisher who's better equipped to service them, you really have to be very diligent in thinking about what's the trade-off here. Is it worth having a go, or actually do we need to go and think about something over here? This client here who's more aligned to our strategy. And so, you know, I sort of liken it to sometimes you have to eat your veggies instead of eating ice cream. Okay, everyone wants to eat ice cream, but a lot of the time you have to eat your veggies, particularly if you're a parent. You know, that's your job as a parent, is to make sure that your children have a nutritious, balanced diet. If it was up to my son, he'd eat ice cream for dinner every night. And my job as his parent is to make sure that he's eating his veggies most of the time. So, crude analogy, but I think the sacrifice thing, I just cannot overstate. And particularly if you're in a sales team or a business where you don't have a lot of resourcing, you don't have a lot of engagement budget, you've got, you know, economic headwinds, you've got a customer base that's challenged, the discipline and the focus and the holding of your nerve and the long-term, particularly the long-term discipline you need to implement to execute a strategy. Because a strategy isn't a three-month thing. A strategy is a couple-of-year thing. I would say that if you are creating a new sales strategy any more than once every 12 months, right, at a maximum, then you're not really being strategic. Because the whole point of this is that you should be able to design something that is relevant and applicable and can withstand the short-term pressures of the marketplace and can withstand the short-term distractions that might get thrown at you by your organization. So doing a quick rundown, again, strategy, it's about sacrifice. You can't be all things to all people. When it comes to sales strategy, you have to have an open mind, but what you're ultimately trying to do is identify where to put time, people, and money in order to get the greatest overall return. The first step of that is define what winning looks like and be specific. Okay, don't put something wishy-washy. Put something specific, measurable, actionable, realistic, and time-bound. The old SMART goal, right? The textbook stuff works. Put something specific around what does winning look like that you believe you can actually achieve, that you think is motivating, but also is something that you can sell internally to your stakeholders as success. The next step from that, the most important step, is identifying where to play. Where are you going to spend the majority of your time? Where are you going to focus most of the time? What pockets of the market represent the most fertile hunting ground for you to put the time, people, and money in order to generate the greatest overall return? Now, that can either be uncontested market space or market space that is heavily contested, but that you have a specific capability or competitive advantage in, and you can be successful there. Fourth and finally, and this is before you start thinking about strategic implementation, but it's something you do need to kind of get out of your brain and you do need to have some boundaries around and you need to police, particularly if you're a leader or you need to self-govern if this is you designing a strategy for yourself. What are we not going to do? What are we going to sacrifice? What are low return activities that we are going to say no to, right? Particularly the things that look attractive but aren't aligned to our strategy. What are those things that we are going to say, no, you know what? It's a shame. I'd love to do it too, but it's not aligned to our strategy. It's going to distract us. It's going to bleed our resourcing. It's going to make our team tired and burnt out. Somebody else is better equipped to win that anyway. And to be honest, we're not even really equipped to play here. Where we're equipped to play is over here. And how we're going to win is this. So we're going to go do that. And that can just be a thing. Okay, that's a really important part of this whole framework. So you go through that process, I guarantee if nothing else, what you're going to unearth is a level of clarity around, okay, at least I have kind of the bare bones of what actually is the stuff that works and what's actually the stuff that just feels superficially like it works, but doesn't necessarily get me the outcome I need. So that's kind of it for now. Again, I think I'm going to have to do a couple of follow-up sessions on this. At some point, I will do a LinkedIn Live because I'll hopefully do some Q&A, or we might even do like a, if anyone wants to, if you want to do like a live strategy workshop with me and we can record it as audio and put it out on the podcast, maybe that's a great way to do it as well. We could actually work through what a sales strategy could look like. You could talk about your market, your challenges. We could put that out there for everybody to listen to. That's it for me in the meantime. Thank you again, obviously, for just supporting the podcast, promoting it, going back and listening to the back catalogue. And I hope to be back with a fresh episode in a few weeks' time with a guest from the USA. Cheers.